Support for WKAR is provided by Liberty Coin Service, now open with a new location in Frandor, offering gold buying and coin collecting services in one combined location for more than 40 years. LibertyCoinService.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.
Good day. Current state on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad to have you along on Tuesday, January 29th. The 6 a.m. temperature in Chicago, I understand, was 60 degrees. And it's almost as crazy here. Today's high temperature in Chicago is forecast to be 67 degrees, which I believe would be a record down there for January 29th. That's not going to surprise anybody. Closer to home, we're supposed to hit about 57, so we're about 10 degrees cooler here today, but the snow's all going to melt. An incredibly sloppy situation outside today, and not surprisingly, there is a flood watch in effect tonight through Wednesday morning with all of the meltage out there, so be aware of that. It's Tuesday morning, January 29th. Last night, Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero portrayed, in his words, a city powered up for the year ahead. For his annual State of the State address, Bernero chose a refurbished railroad depot in the shadow of the city's rising cogeneration power plant from the Board of Water and Light, which will come online this summer. But while Bernero acknowledged Lansing's financial challenges, he steered clear of details. Current State's Kevin Lavery reports.
Lansing Powered Up was the theme of Virge Bernero's 8th State of the City address, and the symbolism was unmistakable. Speaking in Lansing's Rio Town, the mayor addressed a packed house in a beautifully restored century-old train depot. He stood just yards away from the city's newest showpiece, the Lansing Board of Water and Light's $180 million cogeneration power plant, still under construction. Throughout his half-hour address, Bernero fought off a lingering cold with characteristically buoyant salvos of civic pride. He said the state of the city is good and getting better. He cited the lowest unemployment rate in 4 years, growing personal income and rebounding home sales. And Bernero beamed as he clutched a glass plaque honoring a hometown product, the Cadillac ATS.
Last week, the ATS went to the Detroit Auto Show and brought home the biggest prize of all, the North American Car of the Year Award. As we like to say, move over, Mercedes. Beat it, BMW. The new standard of the world is here, and it's made right here in Lansing, Michigan.
Then Bernero produced another prop to highlight another bit of recent automotive news.
Now let me show you something else. See this model car? You know what kind it is? It's a miniature Chevy Camaro. The Camaro is an American classic, one of the most iconic muscle cars in automotive history. And the next generation of this legendary vehicle is coming home, home to America, and right here to Lansing, Michigan.
Bernero mentioned a handful of development successes the city orchestrated in 2012. The repurposing of the former 5th Third Bank building as the new home of Davenport University. A $36 million renovation of the former Knapp's department store, which will become a mix of retail and residential. A new casino project in partnership with the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians. But the mayor's spotlight shone brightest on the Rio Town power plant.
1,000 workers have been employed on this site, most of them members of the skilled building trades. Thank God for the estimated $50 million in wages that this project is pumping into households across our region.
At times, undertones of economic belt tightening echoed through the mayor's words. Randy Talaferro serves as both the Lansing and East Lansing fire chief. Bernero praised his service, announcing his retention for another year. The mayor used the moment to champion his vision of regionalism.
Why not celebrate our neighbors' success? When they win, we win, and vice versa. Because we sink or swim together. That's the truth. In a global economy, we can't afford to waste precious time and resources competing against each other.
Bernero ended by inviting city residents to join him in building the next Lansing. But any such civic engineering must first be balanced against a projected $9 million budget deficit. By law, the mayor must present a balanced budget to the city council by May. He'll need the council's support to push his proposal, including that of his longtime critic and council president, Carol Wood. But Wood says she's ready to cooperate with the mayor.
So far, things are going well on council. We spent an hour and a half and we walked out of it with no bloodshed and shook hands. And so we're ready to move forward.
And Bernero could face another challenge even sooner. A financial health team he appointed in October to review the city's long-term outlook is set to deliver its final recommendations in March. Team leader David Hollister, himself a former mayor, says despite its good management today, Lansing risks facing some of the same financial hardships that led to the economic decline of cities like Flint and Detroit. For WKAR Public Media, I'm Kevin Lavery.
While Michigan continues to be a major center for auto development, the Capital Region is also an area rich in automotive history. Nowhere is this more evident than at the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum in downtown Lansing. The museum houses a diverse collection of Oldsmobiles dating from 1897 to 2004. It also includes countless pieces of automobilia covering about a century, including a nearly complete collection of Michigan license plates, early traffic signs, and a working 1950s-era traffic signal. Steam engine, bicycle, even lawnmower collections show the link between early automakers and many aspects of everyday life. Ransom Eli Olds' earliest automobiles were built throughout the 1890s, and it was Olds, not Henry Ford, who first brought the assembly line process to the automobile. Ransom founded the Olds Motor Vehicle Company in Lansing in 1897. The company was bought by General Motors in 1908, which produced the Oldsmobile brand for 96 years. Ransom Olds continued to produce cars under the name REO Motor Car Company. Bill Adcock is the executive director of the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum. He recently joined WKAR's Peter Wharf for a tour of their museum and a history of the man.
Ari came here when he was a kid, maybe 16 years old, with his parents, and his dad had a machine shop here. He built stationary engines and repaired engines and so forth. They were stationary engines, and it would be, everybody had a stationary engine. If you were a farmer, if you had a garage, you would power everything with that, whether it was a grinder, a saw, you could power your washing machine with that. So even the ladies would have use for a stationary engine.
So what we see at the beginning of the museum is a collection of these engines that were part of everyday life, from the home to, as you said, to the farm to lumber mills.
That's correct. And as things got bigger and better, so did the stationary engines. They went from steam to gasoline. And we have an example here in the corner. It's huge. It's as big as a car, bigger than a car. It's only 18 horsepower, though, but it would run a small factory. But that's how he got his start. He didn't really like horses at all, and so he thought there was a better way, and he built his first steam-powered car, 1886, I believe. He was probably the founder of the automobile industry as we know it. Everybody says Henry Ford was that, and it wasn't. He was building cars. In 1897, he built his first car. We have the car right here. And then over here, this is the first steam car he built in that period of 1883-1887. Didn't work so well. But in 1897, he built his first gas-powered car. It was basically a carriage. They put tiller steering on it. And we have the one and only copy. They built four of them. So I guess it was a production, mass-produced, even though it was four copies. One is left today. We have it behind glass. It belongs to the Smithsonian, but it's on loan. We have a 3-year lease on that, so to speak. We have to keep that in an environmentally controlled atmosphere. So it has to be 70 degrees all the time, 50% humidity, and not much light in there either.
Young Johnny Steele has an Oldsmobile. He loves a dear little girl. She is the queen of his gas machine. She has his heart in a whirl. Now when they go for a spin, you know, she tries to learn the auto. So he lets her steer while he gets her ear and whispers soft and low. Come away with me, Lucille, in my merry Oldsmobile, down the road.
Bill, this is what most people probably imagine in their minds when you think of that first automobile, and this is really one of the first ones. It's a carriage, old carriage-style black body, four wheels, the tiller steering, as you described, and the leaf springs on the front and then two in the back.
Mm-hmm. And they're different than the leaf springs we know today.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. We're talking with Bill Adcock, the executive director of the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum in Lansing.
2 years later, he built his first electric car. This is they built four of them again. This is the only example left in the world. And this is the actual car. Again, it was a carriage style with a tiller steering in it. After this, they said, well, let's build a car company. We know how to build cars. They formed a corporation called Olds Motor Works. Most of it was funded by a guy by the name of Samuel Smith. He was big into copper. They were in Detroit. So they built a factory in Detroit. A few weeks before the production, it burned to the ground. And then a lot of the local people in Lansing, they got together with RE, said, bring your company back here. Rebuild it. We want to have the cars be built in Lansing. A lot of good workers here. And so that's what they did. And eventually they rebuilt the factory in Detroit as well. But they produced the curved dash Olds here. 1903, he left the company. He didn't get along with the management very well. They wanted to make big cars. He said, no, this is what we make. We're making thousands of these now, and you're going to make hundreds of the bigger cars. And so he left. He cashed out his stock. He retired, basically, for a few months. A lot of people in Lansing said, hey, you've got to build another car company. You've got all the technology. You're a wizard at this, and we've got to do that. So another company was born with his name. He was going to call it the R.E. Olds Company. They said, you can't do that. We own that intellectual material, that name. So he just used his initials, Ransom Eli Olds, REO, call it the Rio Motor Company, and that's how we know it today, is the Rio Motor Company.
Isn't it nice when the motor breaks down out in an automobile, leaving you stranded 10 miles out of town out in an automobile? You crawl underneath to repair it, of course. The auto explodes with a great deal of force. You land in the road full of mud every morn, out in an automobile. Out in an automobile, out $20 a day.
Here's a copy here of what would be an original advertisement for one of these curved dash Oldsmobiles. Price, $650. Can you tell us about this, Bill?
Well, again, remember I said that he didn't like horses, and that was the purpose of that. It's waving goodbye to those horses as he goes by in his curved dash Olds. You know, he was the first entrepreneur to actually build a mass-produced car, and he built a progressive assembly line. He was friends with Henry Ford. Henry would visit the factory, as a matter of fact. And then Henry got the idea, well, we can put a belt in this thing, or we can put a chain. We can put something that will draw the whole the car in motion rather than us passing the car one by one. So,
and the sort of the banner for this advertisement is the passing of the horse.
That's correct. And it was, too.
Bill Adcock, he's the executive director of the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum in Lansing. Bill, thanks again for the tour and the time.
Peter, thank you very much.
Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org. Next to Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, Michigan House Speaker Jace Bolger may be the most talked about figure at the state capitol. He's helped steer a long list of Republican-led bills through the House during the early Snyder years. Last year was no exception, but he came under more intense scrutiny after his involvement in the Roy Schmidt party switch fiasco and the passage of hot-button measures like right to work, abortion reform, and others. And the Republican from Marshall opened up recently with reporter Craig Mauger of MERS, and Craig is here to talk about what he walked away with after 40 minutes with the speaker.
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, we had 40 minutes with the speaker on Thursday, and I wanted to say thanks for having me on as well, Mark, today. Hey,
that's all right, Craig. You cover just the House.
I'm the House reporter at MERS. Okay. We're a political news service that covers all types of political issues in Michigan. So.
And MERS, MERSnews.com, by the way.
That's the website, yeah. So if you want to check it out, that's the website you need to go to.
That's how we found out about this, about your sit down with the speaker. You've been covering the House since August, so you haven't been covering the House that long.
No.
But you've gotten to know Jace Bolger pretty well.
Yeah. I've covered his run for re-election competitive race this November, and I've been watching covering the House closely this fall. And in lame duck, we had a lot going on. Obviously, so it's been a busy few months.
A lot going on is an understatement.
Yeah, definitely.
So he's been at or near the eye of the hurricane recently. How many issues? How many different topics did you stir up with him in your 40 minutes?
We talked about just about everything we could talk about in 40 minutes, and he's a political figure here in Michigan that's been through a lot the last year, so we went into that a lot. We're talking about right to work, the Roy Schmidt party switch situation, some other controversies he's been involved with, and we talked about kind of his expectations for the next session, and also how often he disagrees with Governor Snyder, which he said quite frequently with a laugh. So
how about that? Did he go into any detail there on where he's disagreed with him?
He didn't get into those details, but as you can imagine, the governor is a very methodical person. We all know that.
Oh, yeah.
The speaker is a little bit more passionate, I think, so you could see where they would bump heads maybe on some different things.
Did you ask? I know you cover the House, but and there are gun measures going through the Senate right now.
Yes.
These would somehow exempt Michigan guns from changes in federal gun policies. Did that come up?
Oh, yes, that came up with the speaker. Yeah, the bills have been filed in the Senate, and they've already moved out of committee, so they're before the whole Senate now. There have been similar bills filed in the House, but they haven't moved yet. And the speaker says he's not really interested in advancing any of those measures very quickly because he said emotions are so raw right now on both sides. People are fired up about what the president has said, and people are fired up about the number of massacres we've seen in this country over the last year.
So he's taken a page from the Snyder playbook.
Exactly.
It's like, don't move on the gun legislation because it's just too raw right now.
That's exactly right. And he wasn't, I didn't know what I would get when I asked him that question. I didn't know if he would say, like some of his conservative caucus members have said, we need to push forward, we need to do something before the federal government acts, we need to show our state sovereignty. But he said, like the governor has, we need to slow down and take a breath on this issue.
He claims he became most afraid of the opportunity that the opportunity to pass right to work would be lost, and this was something he felt pretty strongly about. And he claims it wasn't apparent until the last 24 to 36 hours of the session that the measure had legs. Did he let on how that unfolded exactly? I mean, I know there was an awful lot of meetings, an awful lot of conversations with union leaders, a lot of talking.
Yeah, it seemed there for those days before it was officially announced that they were going to push forward with it, that the meetings were constant. And in fact, when I met with the speaker on Thursday, I sat in a chair in his office that he said he refers to as the Bob King chair, of course, of the United Auto Workers. So obviously Bob King had been there a couple times maybe.
Oh, so, to be a fly on the wall during those encounters.
That's what I said to him. And he said it might be more interesting to be listening on the conversations both sides had after those encounters, you can imagine.
Well, they took an awful lot of heat over the lack of hearings, mm-hmm. over right to work. Let's listen to something that Jace Bolger said to you about the hearings in particular.
I wanted committee hearings,
yeah.
And yet I was sensitive to, you saw the protests, you saw the disruption, mm-hmm. You saw, and I think there were valid questions over, was a committee process going to change anybody's mind? Was a committee process going to introduce any new thought or ideas?
Interesting response.
Yes, definitely.
The battle lines were drawn. He's suggesting it wouldn't have mattered how many hearings we would have had. The outcome probably would have been the same.
Yeah, I guess he's saying he's not sure on that subject, but it definitely sounds like, I think he said at one point, this is something that I struggled with, whether to do this or not. So some people may say he's just saying that now. Others may see his point of view on this. To a certain extent, he wanted to see this in a committee hearing because he knew that people would say, you didn't fledge this out. And for the most part, this legislature has had committee hearings on important bills. So he kind of thought that it would give this issue and the way it was handled may give people a bad perception on how the House works under his leadership.
Well, he was Nostradamus on that count.
Obviously, yeah, definitely.
Where did he come down on $1 billion plus in new road funding? That did come up,
yes,
correct?
That did come up. He was noncommittal on the subject, but he said the last place he wants to look on this road funding subject is to new taxes. So you can take that for what it's worth if you're the people out there struggling with potholes all over your roads, but that's what he said. So that would seem to indicate that he's not in favor as of right now of some of the things that are being talked about at the Capitol when it comes to roads.
Well, he said find money elsewhere in the budget.
He said
to move on road improvements.
Yeah, and some might say there's no other money in the budget for road improvement with everything else we want to do. So,
now, do you get the impression that he and the governor must be addressing this?
Oh, definitely,
face to face in a lot of detail.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
Well, again, we're talking with Craig Mauger of MERS. Craig had a 40-minute sit down with the Speaker of the House, Jace Bolger, here late last week. And we're listening to some excerpts from that. Of all the topics that came up in your interview, which ones do you think he felt strongest about? Did he, or was he cool, calm, and collected during the whole thing, or did he get worked up about any particular topic?
I wouldn't say he got worked up. I mean, I think he was well prepared for a lot of the subjects that we were going to ask about, but he was very candid. I mean, he didn't dodge any questions. He opened up, and he really talked about everything we had to ask. I asked him a hypothetical question of what would have happened in the 2012 election if the Democrats would have won the House back. You know, they were a few thousand votes from winning the House back, the Democrats were in the election.
Right.
And I said, do you think you guys would have done right to work still if the Democrats had won the House back? And he didn't give me a yes or no, but he said, you know, it would have made it much more difficult because people would have said you're rushing this through to beat the Democrats taking over.
Craig Mauger of MERS joins us here on Current State. Craig, stick around. Hopefully you can join us after the
news
and keep going with Speaker of the House, Jace Bolger. Okay. Coming up, we'll revisit Craig Mauger from MERS. Also, the Michigan University Research Corridor is an economic engine for the state. We'll stir up the latest report there. You're listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. If you have any questions or comments about Current State, you can always email us at currentstate@wkar.org. Or if you'd like to join in on the conversation, follow us on Twitter at @KARCurrentState.
Current State on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org with your feedback, positive, negative, constructive, however you want to put it, or ideas for show segments as well. currentstate@wkar.org. We've got a flood watch in effect tonight through Wednesday morning with all of the melting snow and these unseasonably warm temperatures. Today was forecast to hit about 57 degrees here in the Lansing area. We're talking with MERS News, Craig Mauger, who covers the State House for MERS, the Michigan Information and Research Service, here in Lansing. And you can be updated on Craig's stories and everybody else at MERS, Kyle Malin, the whole crowd at MERSnews.com. Craig had a 40-minute sit-down with Michigan Speaker of the House, Jace Bolger, recently, and that's really what we're talking about here this morning. With regard to right to work again, let's back up a little bit, Craig. Did the speaker let on as to how much Proposal 2 may have increased his own resolve to move forward on right to work? That was, of course, the ballot proposal to get collective bargaining in the Constitution.
Yeah, from the beginning, from the day after the election, the Speaker and his staff have said, that they think Proposal 2 started this debate. And the governor had said that he didn't want to have the debate because it was too divisive. And Speaker Bolger has said, well, the backers of Proposal 2 really started this debate by putting that on the ballot and pushing that initiative. And they felt the legislation, while they say it's not retribution for Proposal 2, they say, it's a continuation of that debate.
I have read that some Republicans actively discouraged unions and Democrats from advancing Prop 2 because it would invite right to work. How much truth to that do you think?
I would think that if you were a Republican in Michigan, you'd probably discourage Proposal 2 being on the ballot in the beginning because you didn't know how it was going to do. But I don't know what the Speaker's feelings is on that, if he discouraged them or not.
He indicated to you that he wants to continue working on big issues, but expressed a desire to work across the aisle. What do you make of that comment?
I think from everything I've heard, that's a pretty traditional idea at the beginning of a legislative session. Let's work together. But also it's important to keep in mind that the Democrats in the House have a few more seats than they had last session. So working with them is also going to be more important to get some of those big things done, like road funding or election reform, some of those things.
Well, it would appear the roads funding does have bipartisan potential.
It would appear
does,
that.
Does it not? Or
I mean, it would appear that way. You never know until the votes are on the board, I guess.
And with regard to how often he disagrees with the governor, what did he have to say?
Oh, he said frequently with a laugh. And I don't know if people would be surprised by that or not, because they definitely have different approaches to policy, I think.
Set up the Roy Schmidt situation here for us, because we've got a clip from the speaker regarding the Roy Schmidt fiasco, the party change fiasco that erupted last summer, just about when you were getting started.
Yeah, definitely. It was obviously for the 2012 election, it was a key issue in the House races. The Speaker and Republicans' involvement in getting Roy Schmidt to switch parties to become a Republican over the summer. And there's currently a grand jury investigation that's ongoing, looking at, what happened there, if there was legal wrongdoing by anyone involved in that.
And lining up a Democratic candidate.
Yeah, basically.
That
that's a key fact.
An unknown. So you had
basically a phantom candidate. Yeah.
You had a really well-established Democrat who switched parties, and then they went so far as to line up this phantom Democrat. Let's hear what Speaker Bolger had to say about that.
I think his switch was absolutely appropriate. There are, however, within that process, several mistakes I made, and I've learned from those mistakes. I've answered every question I can openly and honestly every time I can. The only times I haven't been able to, frankly, are frustrating. But yeah, I've learned lessons from that, and I would certainly do things differently. But if somebody wanted to switch parties, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, and I would certainly talk to somebody who wanted to do that again.
Anything you want to follow up with on that?
No, it's just it's a very interesting clip, obviously, and I think some people on the Democratic side of things would be angered by that, I would say.
Did he admit to worrying about not getting reelected last November? I mean, he won by just a few thousand votes.
It was a few hundred votes.
A few hundred.
I didn't ask him if he was worried about it. I'm sure he was, though, because the Republicans spent a lot of money to make sure that he was reelected, and the Democrats spent a lot of money in that district to try to make sure he wasn't.
But a few hundred votes was all the margin
there.
And now he's Speaker of the House again. So he was reelected. How much you visited Calhoun County and Marshall, which is the district he represents. How much do you know about the vibe he has with his constituents?
It's hard to say on that one. I mean, obviously, despite all the money that the Democrats put into the district, they sent him back. They sent him back to the House. It's a Republican leaning district too. That's something important to note. So,
one other interesting thing, and this has less to do with Speaker Bulger, but I'll bring it up, that I learned from the MERS podcast yesterday is that the state's 0.08 blood alcohol limit for drivers is scheduled to expire. That is sunsetted, and that came up in the MERS podcast yesterday.
Definitely.
I'm not sure a whole lot of people are aware of that.
No, apparently not. We've had a lot of feedback on that on the podcast. We looked through a flood of bills that come in early in the session, and we found this bill from Representative Andrea LaFontaine saying, you know, trying to eliminate this sunset provision that would send the BAC limit to 0.10.
It would back up to 0.1 from 0.08.
Yeah, definitely. So, it's pretty interesting, and it sounds like when they changed it to 0.08, that took effect in 2003. For some reason, this phase-out or sunset, no one's sure what to call it, was put in the law. So that'll be an interesting thing to watch.
But it has to, some kind of legislation has to be passed in order to keep it at 0.08. I want to make sure I understand that.
That's what sources are telling us.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
And it's one of the, apparently, it's one of the Michigan State Police's priorities for the session. So,
how about that? Very interesting.
Yeah. And if you want to listen to the whole podcast, it's free on our website, MERSnews.com, I should also say.
MERSnews.com. That's MERS with an I. MIRS
yes,
News.
Thank you.
.com.
Thank you for that.
a lot of people go looking for you at MERS, and that's a totally different thing. Craig Mauger of MERS. Many thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Current state on WKAR, a new report from East Lansing's Anderson Economic Group lays out a compelling case for Michigan's University Research Corridor. The URC is an alliance comprised of Michigan State University, the University of Michigan, and Wayne State University, and the focus is on leveraging the research being done at those institutions into economic stimulus. That's the point. And this new report, which covers calendar year 2011, finds URC activity led to $15.5 billion in total economic activity in the state. The three schools spent more than $2 billion on research and awarded tens of thousands of degrees. And here to go deeper into the report and what it means are Jeff Mason, Executive Director of the URC. Aaron Grover is the lead author of the report, which is conducted by the Anderson Economic Group of East Lansing. And John Austin runs the Michigan Economic Center at Prima Civitas, the East Lansing-based economic developer. and sometimes liver disease. I was complimented the other day for my pronunciation of prima civitas by Holly Hetzner, because she said a lot of people will say prima civitas, and it makes it sound like a liver disease.
But what does it mean?
It means first city, right?
First city, first state.
First city, first state. Okay, well done. And it's not a liver
disease.
Latin. Okay. And John, and you're also a member of the Michigan, the State Board of Education.
President
of the State Board of Education. Welcome to all of you, to Current State. I'll throw this first one out to anyone. Put these colossal numbers into a more understandable perspective for us. There's apparently a huge economic impact resulting from university research, from degree granting, etc. What is some visible evidence of this university activity that somebody here in the Lansing area might easily relate to? Jeff, anybody?
Yeah, sure. I'll take that one or start with that. I mean, I think when you think about these three major research universities here in the state of Michigan, we compare it, and Anderson has done this research for us for the past 6 years now, where we have benchmarked ourselves against six other innovation clusters around the nation. Places like Research Triangle Park in North Carolina, or MIT and Harvard and Tufts up in the Massachusetts-Boston area, mm-hmm. or Northern California with Stanford and UC Berkeley and UC San Francisco. We think these innovation clusters is where the economy flourishes with knowledge-based activity. And that's where the economies of the future are going to grow and prosper. And we've tried to show that Michigan, through the University Research Corridor and these three world-class universities, can compare with them. We're on par with them in terms of research activity, in terms of students that we graduate, in terms of economic activity. A tangible example of that here in the Lansing area, Mark, would be the IBM Research Center here, that IBM opened up a computer development center in the old MSU Federal Credit Building. They came here to Michigan and East Lansing because of the talent that exists at this world-class university.
Okay.
And they have a connection with the engineering school and the Comm Arts School. Students are being graduated out of programs and going to work for them. That's where we think you see vibrant connections between the universities and the economy here in the state of Michigan.
Aaron Grover, can you give us a handle on how you go about measuring all of this economic activity? It gives me a headache just to think about it, but you did it. How do you do that?
Right. So we included things, the expenditures in instruction, research, U of M's hospital, faculty and staff wages and benefits, the student expenditures, and then incremental alumni earnings. We are really careful to only take into account net new spending, which means we don't count economic activity that replaces other economic activity in the region.
Okay. All right.
And I would just say, John Austin, if anything, the economic impact numbers, which are incredible, you know, what is it, $15.5 billion, only count the direct impact in terms of dollars spent, faculty employed, the research dollars that flow in. They don't count even many of the things that Jeff was in Jeff's example. They don't count the new firms and spillovers, as we call them, that
That's
get created and percolate around research universities where all the action and growing the economy comes. They don't count the fact that firms would locate here because they have an interaction with the university. So if anything, the economic benefit is considerably higher than these very conservative numbers say.
I guess so. Yeah.
I agree with that. This is definitely, you know, a very conservative estimate of what the economic benefit would be. You know, there are a lot of tangible, intangible benefits that we really can't quantify.
Right.
So,
how long has the URC been around?
So the URC was created back in 2006 by President Luana Simon, Mary Sue Coleman, the president of U of M, and at the time, Irv Reed, the president at Wayne State University. So we've been in existence about 6 years, one of the things we've done during that time is really benchmark and compare ourselves, because we really want to, you know, see how we stack up. You know, if you want to be the best, you got to compare yourselves to the best. And so by looking and comparing ourselves objectively against some of these other innovation clusters, we can track and see how we're doing in terms of performance.
Are you confident you're measuring apples to apples when you compare these numbers with these other research clusters?
Yeah, you know, you can never exactly get, apples to apples. For example, you know, in Massachusetts, you've got Harvard and MIT, private institutions. We are three public universities. But we are typically trying to compare ourselves to Carnegie, highly intensive classified research universities. So that's a categorization that looks at and as nationally ranks universities based on different measures. And so we use some fairly objective terminology and definitions to compare ourselves.
So you do have some benchmarks. You
got the simplest is who wins competitive federal research dollars, because it is the place that can solve the world's problems in healthcare and in energy and in engineering. It is these great public universities who've had incredible success, more success relative to some of those other private institutions in winning competitive research, which is flowing into our state and flowing talent and new problem solving. These institutions have been around, the URC institutions, as great public universities for 100-plus
right.
years. It was one of the greatest inventions in this country, the great public land grant and public universities that provided high-quality, low-cost education for every man and were purposefully designed to aid commerce, agriculture, business development. And they are different from the privates, meaning they've relied significantly on our states, our tax dollar support.
Right.
And so if we're going to continue to fuel the growth of our economy, we have to do better at supporting and flowing dollars in to pay for the researchers, the students, the graduate students, and the facilities that allow us to continue to be the place that solves the world problems and invents the new technologies right here in Michigan.
And John Austin, since you are the president of the State Board of Education, this really begs the question of just where you stand on education funding in Michigan, if I could ask you that.
Yeah, and education and higher education and research don't happen magically. They're things that the private sector doesn't do. The basic research that invents things like the internet, which our Big Ten universities had a hand in, comes from us dedicating our tax dollars. So it's the best investment we can make, and we need to invest more in both K-12, but higher education and higher education research is the best investment to grow the next economy right here.
Is private money going up in terms of donations to the URC schools?
Well, certainly the endowments and the giving is something that is a process that the universities actively work at. The endowments have been growing somewhat over the past few years. I think the other important thing to note, Mark, is, you know, in terms of engagement with the private sector, these universities are very committed to not only the research that goes on in the labs and educating students, but also engaging with the private sector and companies here in the state of Michigan. The IBM is one example, but Google down in Ann Arbor was attracted down there because of the connection to the University of Michigan. Each of the universities have now created one-stop business corporate relationship offices to make that engagement with companies and industry easier and simpler to engage in. But the report that AEG prepared showed that for every $1 the state of Michigan invests in these three institutions, you know, we return $17 to the economy. So a return on investment of 17-1 is a pretty good ROI, and we think that suggests that, you know, the universities are contributing to the economy and see that as part of their mission.
And that's in addition to the $375 million that the state gets in tax revenue from URC alumni and URC employees.
Okay. You analyzed this thing regionally. You
yes.
looked at different regions. Tell mm-hmm. us how that works.
So the MEDC, the Michigan Economic Development Corp, put together 10 economic regions. And so we took the state economic impact and looked at where the expenditures were located, and we allocated them to each of the regions based on that.
Any surprises there?
No. I think, unsurprisingly, the biggest economic impacts were in the areas that the universities themselves were located.
Okay. So there really is a corridor between East Lansing and Detroit that stretches and connects the three.
Right.
Okay.
But I think the other interesting piece of that, Mark, is that even in the UP, there's $60 million of economic impact that these three universities have in the Upper Peninsula. So, people in Michigan may not think that the institutions have that kind of impact, but they make a significant contribution, whether it's students that are attending these institutions from around the state and from every 83 counties, the alumni that graduate that then return and
cooperative
work in those
extension
communities.
What about cooperative extension? Is that's a factor here, I would imagine?
Absolutely.
Yeah. MSU cooperative extension.
Right.
And I would assume, Jeff, these three URC institutions, which are part of the 15 public universities, are often collaborating with the other universities like Michigan Tech and Northern, for example, on significant projects in biomass or clean energy or clean water. And,
right.
And, that's a contribution, too.
Well,
that is.
Well, do you ever get lobbied from Michigan Tech to say, hey, let's make the university research corridor include Michigan Tech? They got a lot of good stuff going on up there.
Absolutely. I mean, there are 15 great public universities here in the state of Michigan, and our three represent about 93% of all the research and development expenditures.
Wow.
Of those 15. But we do collaborate with the other universities on particular research activities. Michigan Tech up in Houghton has a very strong engineering and applied research program up there. We are working with five other universities around the state of Michigan in a program to try to retain more international students. So we build relationships and collaborations with other institutions, both public and private, here in the state to advance important objectives.
Seriously, do other universities want to join? I mean, do you ever hear, do you ever get lobbied to expand it to four?
The point of branding and naming the URC is just to name the reality that these three institutions do both win and do the bulk of the globally significant research that draws talent and creates new technologies and people in Michigan. So we haven't always considered them as a critical mass like Silicon Valley and Stanford and Berkeley. So part of it is to just appreciate we have the horsepower and the innovation horsepower and the talent generation horsepower here that's co-equal with any of the places that we think of the great university research and innovation centers. So we should not only appreciate that, we should build on it. That's what Jeff and the presidents are doing. And we should accelerate it because we can be the place that creates all the new ideas and technologies to solve all the world's problems in Michigan and create a lot of jobs doing it if we fuel and feed these great research institutions.
How do you do that? How do you build it? How do you hit the gas on this thing?
Well, for example, we have been cutting funding for our universities for 12 or 13 years. It plateaued last year, which is, of course, the wrong way to go if you want to grow the footprint of learning, people, talent, and new discovery. And that's the exact opposite way of how we drive this economy. Other states have put, for example, Ohio asked the people for $2.8 billion to fuel research university-led new business commercialization and development. That's what we should be doing more of here, to help the universities accelerate their commercialization of all the new ideas that are cooked up with the private sector.
We've got under a minute, and I want to wind you up with a quick question. I imagine each school brings something different to the table, and you add it all up and you get something really big and special. What does each bring, or is that not the way to look at this thing?
No, I think there are some unique differences. I mean, Wayne State University is a premier urban research institute. So they bring some of the laboratories in the city of Detroit and the ability to look at that. Michigan State University, a premier land-grant institution. And U of M, probably the most premier public university in the nation or maybe in the world. So when you put kind of the strengths of those three together, we talk about the fact that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. We think it's a winning combination.
Very good. Jeff Mason, Executive Director of the University Research Corridor. Aaron Grover, lead author of the report from Anderson Economic Group of East Lansing. John Austin runs the Michigan Economic Center at Prima Civitas and is also president of the Michigan Board of Education. Many thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it a lot. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, President of the Lansing School Board, Carol Wood, responds to Mayor Virge Bernero's State of the City address last night. And we'll be back with another other great segments tomorrow. We're eager to hear from you in the meantime. Current State at WKAR.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing Community College Foundation, supporting students struggling to afford access to education that could change their lives. More at ichange.lcc.edu. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.